This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا مِنْهُ وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَاهُ نَعْمَاءَ بَعْدَ ضَرَّاءَ مَسَّتْهُ لَيَقُولَنَّ ذَهَبَ السَّيِّئَاتُ عَنِّي إِنَّهُ لَفَرِحٌ فَخُورٌ الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير صدق الله
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, The evils are gone away from me. Most surely, he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good. They shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Our headlines: Iran censures the UN for refusing to block this Israel and the Saudi-led coalition over their crimes against Palestinian and Yemeni children. The U.S. says its base in Syria has been hit with rockets almost a day after its airstrikes on Iraq-Syria border facilities killed several Iraqi resistance members. Some 10 million Australians go under lockdown amid an outbreak of the highly contagious Delta variant of COVID-19. Thank you for joining us. Beginning with our top story, Iran's ambassador to the United Nations has criticized the world body for excluding Israel and the Saudi-led coalition from its list of violators of children's rights. Majid Takhravanchi said, "The most systematic and gross violation of the rights of children in West Asia continues by the Israeli regime." He cited UN data that showed over 1,000 cases of Israeli violations against 340 Palestinian children. Takhravanchi also said over 3,500 children have been killed in the Saudi-led war on Yemen, as stated by a UN report. The UN Secretary General added Yemen's Ansarullah movement to the blacklist, citing an alleged use of child soldiers. Yemen, however, has vehemently rejected the accusation. Political commentator Jafar Ramini says the United Nations was created as a tool for Western powers to make the rest of the world believe they are upholders of democratic and human values. Let's take a listen.
Nobody should look for any justice or any humanity from the UN. The UN was created as a tool for Western powers to show that they are democratic and they have human values. Nothing of the sort. While you have America in there exercising the right of veto, nothing tangible or nothing human will happen. Israel is protected. They are the favorite child of the United States of America, and so is Saudi Arabia. And there is this sacred cow called the West's interest that should be protected at any cost. And if you look at the social media, there is every day at least a dozen pictures of Palestinian children of the age of 7, 8, and 9, and sometimes even 5, are dragged brutally by the Israeli occupation forces, put in prison, not allowed access by their parents or legal representation.
Iran has marked the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of the Iran Islamic Republic Party by the U.S.-backed Mujahideen-e-Khalq terror organization known as the MKO. The occasion is marked every year as part of week-long ceremonies dubbed the American Human Rights Week. Youssef Jalali reports.
Rights activists, along with families of terror victims in Iran, attended this gathering in Tehran to mark the American Human Rights Week. The annual occasion aims to shed light on the U.S.'s record of rights violations in Iran.
We're marking the American Human Rights Week to review the numerous cases where the U.S. openly violated human rights in our country. fact, the American Navy's downing of our passenger plane in 1988, after which the perpetrators received a badge of honor in the U.S. The latest crime the U.S. has committed was to assassinate the spearhead of the fight against terrorism, General Qasem Soleimani.
The second day of the week-long occasion marks the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of the Iran Islamic Republic Party in Tehran by the U.S.-backed Mujahideen-e-Khalq terror organization, known as the MKO. 73 leading officials of the Islamic Republic were killed, including former Justice Chief Ayatollah Muhammad Ali Beheshti.
Iran says it has lost over 17,000 people in terrorist attacks. 12,000 of them were killed at the hands of the formidable MKO terrorist group. What's even more shocking is that the U.S. does not regard the MKO as a terrorist entity and has even established intimate ties with them.
The U.S. and Europe delisted the MKO as a terrorist organization. Following this measure, the group was relocated from its former stronghold at a U.S. military base in Iraq to Albania and France. Ever since, the MKO has held regular meetings with American and European officials.
Members of U.S. Congress regularly meet MKO leaders where they offer any kind of support to the terrorist group. The U.S. is still supporting the terrorists in their anti-Iran campaigns. The MKO killed our top nuclear scientists, and that was not possible without the U.S. and Israel's assistance.
I lost my husband in the 1981 bombing of the Islamic Republic Central Office by the MKO. Interestingly, the spearhead of the terrorist operation, whose real name is Ali Mohtamed, took refuge in the Netherlands, and they welcomed him until a few years ago when the MKO disposed of him as a lost cause.
The American Human Rights Week started on June 27th, which marks the anniversary of the failed assassination of the then-Iranian president Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei by the MKO terrorists in 1981. And will end on July the 3rd, which coincides with the anniversary of the U.S. Navy's shooting down of an Iranian passenger plane in 1988. Organizers of the occasion say the ultimate goal of the week-long ceremonies is to expose the U.S.'s double standards when it comes to the issue of human rights. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Syrian media say several rockets have been fired at a U.S. military base at the Al Omar oil field located in the country's east. Reports say the attack caused damage to the base, but no casualties. This comes less than 24 hours after the U.S. airstrikes targeted positions of Iraq's popular mobilization units on both sides of the Iraq-Syria border. Our correspondent in Syria has more updates.
Mortar shells were fired, and they hit a U.S. Base in an area in the Al-Zour countryside in, of course, Al-Omar oil field. The mortar shells hit and targeted a U.S. base over there. This is according to the state news agency over here in Syria. We still don't have any comments from the United States on this particular attack. In fact, this is one of the largest and most richest oil fields in Syria, Al-Omar oil field, which is in Deir ez-Zor countryside. It is occupied by the United States. The United States occupies many parts of Syria in the north, where it is a rich area of oil. It is giving all of that oil to the Kurdish side, the so-called Syria's Democratic Forces, and also using some of that oil in order to finance its presence inside Syria and Iraq.
Palestinian farmers and traders in the Gaza Strip have held a rally to voice their anger at Israel over its inhumane restrictions put on exporting goods and crops. The demonstrators say the restrictions have led to dire economic crisis in the impoverished enclave. Ruba Shabit has more in this report from Gaza.
Farmers, traders, and exporters of agricultural crops held a demonstration in front of the United Nations headquarters in Gaza to deliver the representative of the United Nations a protest letter against new restrictions imposed by Israel to export Palestinian agricultural crops like vegetables. Israeli closure of borders has led to a huge damage in the agricultural sector of the Gaza Strip.
We have come here to protest against Israeli closure of borders. We want to sell our products in the West Bank and other parts of the world. Israel intends to ruin our lives by adopting such restrictive measures. We call on all human rights organizations to do something.
Palestinian farmers are facing serious financial losses due to the Israeli closure of borders. This is viewed in Gaza as part of a larger plan by Israel to destroy Palestinian economy. Palestinian farmers called on the international community to be committed to its responsibilities and pressurize Israel into opening the borders.
Israel's new restrictive measures will ruin our crops before they reach the target markets. All of our vegetables are stuck here and eventually destroyed. I'm standing here to protest these restrictions that have made our lives unbearable. We demand opening of the borders so we can export our products. This blockade is inhumane.
Along with the Israeli ban on export, the latest aggression on the Gaza Strip has doupled the damage in the agricultural sector. This has led to severe losses in this sector as Palestinian farmers can barely afford the living.
Our message to the United Nations is that Israel's measures are aimed to deteriorate life of all Palestinian farmers and traders. The latest Israeli aggression has inflicted a heavy blow on the agricultural sector. Israeli restrictions have no purpose but to ruin the agricultural sector of Gaza.
Due to the Israeli ban on the exportation of goods, the prices for agricultural products in Gaza have dropped significantly. Palestinian farmers and traders here say that the Israeli restrictions imposed on exporting crops aim to destroy the Palestinian economy. They call on the international community to end these restrictions and open the borders. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
More major cities in Australia impose COVID-19 lockdown measures to fight flare-ups of the highly contagious Delta variant. Brisbane, the capital of Queensland state, has become the fourth major city to issue stay-at-home orders. The three-day snap lockdown there begins on Tuesday evening. Sydney, Perth, and Darwin have already issued similar orders. In total, 10 million Australians are now under lockdown. The country has been broadly successful in containing virus clusters, but now the authorities say they have to be cautious and take what they call tough decisions due to the Delta variant. The strain was first identified in India. The UK Conservative government has been rocked by another scandal, this time involving its former Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, who resigned after he breached COVID protocols. His replacement, former Chancellor Sajid Javid, has promised to tackle both the country's lockdown uncertainty and bring the faltering health service under control. But his critics are asking if he's the right man for the job. Amina Taylor has more from London.
Britain has a new man in charge of the country's health service. Former Chancellor Sajid Javid replaces Matt Hancock to helm the most under-pressure department in government. First point of order, attempting to manage the COVID crisis.
I want to see the restrictions lifted and life going back to normal as quickly as possible. And that's at my right here and now, that is my absolute priority.
But this is no ordinary cabinet reshuffle. Previous Health Minister Matt Hancock was forced to step down after embarrassing revelations about his private conduct were made public.
I understand the enormous sacrifices that everybody in this country has made, that you have made, and those of us who make these rules have got to stick by them, and that's why I've got to resign.
Despite presiding over the shambolic handling of Britain's COVID response, it became clear that Hancock had fallen out of favour inside Downing Street.
I think it's really likely he was pushed. The exact provenance of the CCTV footage from within his office is not clear, but it's clear that it would be very hard to access that if you weren't in some way strongly connected to the government. So if Boris didn't want him to go, someone did very much. Quite clear that his position was no longer tenable.
For those hoping there'd be a change in approach from the new health chief, they may well be disappointed.
There is no ideological difference between Sajid Javid and Matt Hancock. It's a new face, just as Jeremy Hunt. Jeremy Hunt became an absolutely figure of hate while he was presiding over the NHS, precisely because he was implementing these ongoing privatisation policies. We're living with the consequences of the NHS being driven into the ground. We've seen unprecedented, really corruption, giving away, gifting tens and hundreds of billions during this pandemic. Savid Javid, I have no doubt, will continue in the same line.
Britain's National Health Service was already creaking at the seams even before the pandemic. And for the millions who've been waiting to see a medical professional, well, they won't mind who is in charge of the health service. They just want to be made better, and made better soon. With COVID dominating the health agenda, Sajid Javid will have his work cut out for him. And as the fate of his two predecessors has shown, landing the top job is the easy part. Amina Taylor, London.
Three Brazilian senators have sued President Jair Bolsonaro and the Supreme Court for his role in a COVID-19 vaccine deal that is under investigation for alleged irregularities. The complaint comes after a Senate commission reported that Bolsonaro knew about suspected corruption of a $300 million deal, but failed to intervene. Bolsonaro has denied any wrongdoing. More than 514,000 people have died from the virus in Brazil. Bolsonaro has seen his popularity fade after playing down virus severity, shunning lockdowns, and touting unproven miracle cures. A criminal case against the president before the Supreme Court could see him removed from office, although the prosecutor general, who is Bolsonaro's ally, has to bring charges. Canadian police have launched an investigation into the vandalism of a statue of a former head of the Roman Catholic Church, Pope John Paul II, in Edmonton. Dozens of red handprints ringed the statue and paint was smeared across it. The incident came amid simmering anger over the discovery of hundreds of unmarked graves at former church and schools for Indigenous children in Saskatchewan and British Columbia. Several churches have been set ablaze while there were reports of attacks on Western religious figures this week. Thousands of Aboriginal children in Canada were forcibly separated from their families during the last century and were sent to residential schools where many of them suffered ill treatment and sexual abuse. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has urged the Pope to come to Canada to apologize for the Catholic Church's role in running those schools. The Catholic Church in Poland faces a wave of allegations of sexual abuse amid an investigation into alleged cover-ups by a senior clergyman. Take a listen.
There is still potential, and I say potential in quotes, to expand the disclosures. There are certainly still many hidden cases that probably continue to be reported.
Sock also noted that a wave of revelations has been presented and the figures are persistently quite high. The Polish episcopate said it had received some 370 reports regarding the sexual abuse of minors between July 2018 and December 2020. Preliminary investigations had verified 144 of the reports and found them reliable. Another 186 are still under investigation, while only 38 have so far been rejected as unreliable. The developments come as the Vatican investigated one of the most senior figures in the Polish church accused of covering up pedophile allegations. Well, that's your word news for now.
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends, no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, unless Thou repelst him. By means of name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
In the limelight.
masked Zionist troops will still terrorize Palestinian children in the middle of the night, but new military jargon will hide the true purpose, says Jonathan Cook, journalist, in an article titled, Israeli regime's night raids on Palestinian families aren't over. Please stay tuned for the second part of the article. Even some former Zionist troops understand that the intelligence gathering rationales for these invasions are bogus. Several told the human rights groups that the intelligence supposedly gained from these operations was never put to later use. None could identify a database where the information was being stored. Even if the mapping raids were primarily about collecting information, the army has far more effective means to spy on and control the Palestinian population in the occupied territories of the West Bank and East Al-Quds. The job of Unit 8200, one of the Israeli regime's military many intelligence gathering arms, includes listening in on Palestinian communications to find secrets that can be used to blackmail and extort Palestinians to collaborate with occupation authorities. A so-called cyber unit in Israeli regime's so-called justice ministry is tasked with spying on Palestinians' internet and social media communications. And the Zionist regime has endless other sources of intelligence on Palestinians. Collaborators, the Palestinian Population Registry that it controls, biometric identity documents, face recognition technology, questioning at checkpoints, the use of drones, and the seizure of Palestinians for interrogation. More importantly, the army knows that it can continue as before with these home invasions by using other pretexts. It will subsume mapping operations within even more violent categories of night raids, such as the search for weapons, interrogations of children, about stoning, throwing, or arrest. Sadly, the Zionist regime courts have always shown a willingness to collude with the Zionist regime army in precisely these kinds of face-saving deceptions and cynical manipulations of language. There is no reason to believe that the Israeli regime legal system will do anything in practice to ensure that home invasions, whether for mapping or any other purpose, come to an end. The record of the Zionist regime courts has been consistently dismal in protecting Palestinians from Israeli regime army abuses. Even when the courts do belatedly rule against army protocols that flagrantly violate international law, the army invariably finds ways to undercut the ruling, usually with the court's complicity. For years, the army has continued to use Palestinians as human shields, dragging out legal proceedings by recharacterizing the practice as a so-called neighbor procedure or prior warning. It is not hard to imagine that intel mapping could be given a similar linguistic makeover. And there is an additional reason to be skeptical. More than 20 years ago, the Zionist regime top court banned the torture of Palestinian detainees, yet it continued almost unabated because the court created a loophole for cases defined as ticking bombs, when interrogators supposedly faced the race against time to extract information to save lives. After the ruling, it seemed that every Palestinian seized by the army became a ticking bomb. Finally, in 2017, the court reversed its 1999 ruling when it permitted torture as long as interrogators did not cross a threshold of pain that it declined to determine in advance. The reality is that when the Zionist regime treats its occupation as permanent, then preserving the occupation's infrastructure for surveillance, control, intimidation, and humiliation becomes an absolute necessity. When the occupier additionally seeks to drive out Palestinians to replace them with its own settler population, the rot runs deeper still. Palestinian men, women, and children are reduced to nothing more than pieces to be swept off a chessboard. For that reason, home invasions, the terrorizing of families in the middle of the night by masked troops will continue, whatever euphemism is used to justify it.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The harsh sanctions against Iran's civil aviation industry. January 12, 2017. Tehran, Mehrabad Airport. A new airplane has arrived in Iran after more than three decades. Purchasing this airplane from Airbus Company was made possible by the Iran nuclear deal, known as the JCPOA. In 2018 alone, Iranian aviation companies transported some 30 million passengers via local and international flights. The task was achieved by 18 airlines, with a total of 150 active airplanes. Iran's civil aviation industry was one of the first sectors to be restricted and sanctioned during the first days of the Islamic Revolution of 1979. As the scope of the sanctions expanded in the following years, the development of this industry was slowed down, to an extent that some of the neighboring countries that had founded their aviation industry decades after Iran got ahead. Despite the pressure on it and the loss of money and lives, due to the existing demand in the country and the support given by the government, Iran's aviation industry was able to survive and continue its activities. Now, the question that comes to mind is how an industry which was completely imported from outside not only remained in business, but also achieved growth. How were they able to purchase airplanes? How did Iran find the professional human resources and specialists? Do international regulations match the sanctions imposed on the industry? In an industry which the life cycle of all parts and equipment are inspected under international regulations, how did Iran get the spare parts and certificates needed to continue to work? When the Iran nuclear deal was signed in 2015, what opportunities opened to the industry?
The JCPOA for aviation was not fair play. They designed a very dirty play against the aviation industry of Iran.
This is an inside story of efforts made to keep this very modern industry running, despite the harsh sanctions levied against Iran. With the establishment of companies such as Iranian Airways and Persian Air Services in the 1940s, Iran's civil aviation industry began its work. However, the official start of this industry in Iran dates back to the year 1962. On February 24 of that year, the government ordered the merger of Iran Airways and Persian Air Services, establishing the Iranian National Airline, or Iran Air, as a state-run flag carrier air service company. Iran Air, which is also known as HOMA, grew quickly due to the support lent by the government, and in the 1970s blossomed into a successful airline. In 1975, Iran Air was the fastest growing airline in the world, with dozens of flights to European countries per week. Iran was also among the first countries in the world to purchase the Boeing 747 SP, which was the most modern airplane of the time. After buying the aircraft, Iran was able to launch one of the longest non-stop air services between Tehran and New York at the time. Captain Abdullahi, who is currently the oldest living pilot in Iran, was in charge of Iran Air flight operations back then. Iran Air was in full blossom. However, when it came to maintenance, it was totally dependent on foreign companies. With the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran, many Westerners who worked in various industries, including the aviation industry, left the country. The exit of these Western specialists was a big shock to the industry, prompting the local forces to fill the void. Four days after the U.S. Embassy takeover in Tehran, on November 8, 1979, the control tower at New York's JFK Airport contacted an Iran Air airliner as it was approaching for landing. It informed the captain that due to political tensions between the United States and Iran, the passenger plane had been denied permission for landing in all U.S. airports. The aircraft was then forced to fly on to Canada for landing. From then on, all flights between Tehran and New York, among the longest non-stop flight routes, were canceled. Over the course of the next four decades, and under different pretexts, the scope of U.S.-imposed sanctions on Iran expanded. U.S.-imposed sanctions on Iran included a network of interconnected restrictions imposed on the Iranian nation by both the U.S. President and Congress. The sanctions targeted economic investments in Iran, the oil and aviation industries, science and technology firms, and even the country's central bank. As a result of the unilateral U.S. sanctions, other countries, too, were practically unable to do business with the Islamic Republic. This was because the sanctions targeting the international business firms and governments which wanted to do business with Iran would either be punished by the U.S. or risk losing their ties with the U.S. In the past couple of years, it has practically become impossible for Iran to purchase airplanes or its spare parts from manufacturing companies across the globe. This dire situation has forced Iranian airlines to either seek spare parts via unofficial channels or through third parties. The sanctions ban Iran from obtaining equipment and spare parts, which use more than 10% by value of U.S. technology or services for their production. The situation has prevented Iran from purchasing new airplanes for decades, turning Iran's air fleet into one of the oldest in the world. But how do the sanctions work, and what impact do they have on the country's aviation industry? To better understand this matter, different aspects must be reviewed separately.
Unfortunately, the sanction we have imposed on us has impacted the entire air transport industry. It's not only airline. We have seen that also airport, air navigation system, also the process of transferring money from Iranian airline to other airlines have been affected.
Due to the high prices of new airplanes, they are purchased via companies that provide financial services. Finance companies act as go-betweens and sign a contract with the buyer to purchase an airplane from the manufacturer.
We are looking everywhere in the market, but we cannot lease aircraft from the very famous leasing companies because they don't want work with Iran due to lack of OFAC license. So we have to go to the open market brokers, which it takes time and, of course, more expensive for us.
An unofficial market with limited sellers in it, in addition to the problems related to financing the purchases and the difficulty of transferring money. Iranian airlines were left with few options, forcing them over the years to buy any type of airplane that they could get their hands on. Having an old fleet is not a problem per se, as long as the necessary maintenance is done to the planes and the spare parts needed for them are available. However, in Iran's case, the bans and restrictions they employed for the routine repairs and maintenance led to complications. Sometimes not finding an essential part, like an engine, makes an airplane useless.
737 fleet in Osman Airlines during 25 years of operation has never faced with any incident or accident. Very safe fleet for Osman Airlines. But we found that due to lack of support by Boeing, we are not able more to continue operation of his aircraft. By this means, we ground 3 aircraft 737 with 500 seats. We lose this revenue, which was very good revenue for us, but we respect the safety.
In practice, such limitations have a real impact on flight operations and force the schedules to change. At Iranian Airlines, delays and cancellations of flights due to technical problems often occur. Under such circumstances, in order to maintain safety measures, there is no other choices. These delays and cancellations are not only harmful to airlines' income and planning, but also have a negative psychological impact on passengers. To hear a flight has been delayed or canceled, even if it is for non-technical problems, can make passengers anxious. Another odd problem related to the sanctions is that airports in other countries refuse to give jet fuel to Iranian planes on international routes. After the Iran nuclear deal, the ban on fuel was removed. However, as the United States pulled out of the deal, the situation became more complicated than before. Sometimes foreign airports would refuse to give Iranian flights even the most basic services. The issue, which experts have contradicting views about, is the degree to which the numerous restrictions have affected the safety of Iranian flights. Despite some experts saying that in the present situation, Iranian flights are unsafe, others working in this field believe it to be otherwise. Aside from its short-term impacts, the U.S. sanctions have had long-term negative impact on the country. Iran is a huge country with an area four times that of Germany, with a vast range of geographical features, including cold mountainous regions in the north and west, massive hot deserts in the central parts, and warm and humid coasts in the Persian Gulf. One of the best ways to decrease the length of time required to reach and connect remote locations of the country is to provide sustainable and balanced development by expanding the aviation industry. Despite the high portion of airports across the country, due to the sanctions, Iran is not capable of buying small short-range airplanes to provide air service to them. That is why many of these airports are hardly active. This problem has slowed down the economic growth and development in remote areas. Due to the global nature of aviation, slapping sanctions on a part of the aviation industry will have repercussions that go beyond the limits of the local airlines and the people of the region. Iran's unique geographical location prompts many international flights to use its airspace to pass from the south of the Persian Gulf over to the west or north of the country. In order to provide satisfactory services for the international flights flying over Iran and passing through its airspace, airports must be equipped with modern, updated technology to match latest standards. In December 2018, a Norwegian MAX 737 jetliner flying from Dubai to Stockholm lost one of its engines when passing over Iran. The aircraft was forced to make an emergency landing in Shiraz International Airport in southern Iran. The incident coincided with the temporary shutdown of the U.S. government. As a result, the jetliner was grounded for 70 days until the Norwegian company was able to receive an OFAC license to transfer a new engine to Iran. During the period that the U.S. sanctions had been imposed on the nation, Iran's Civil Aviation Organization has made many efforts at various international bodies to inform the global community of the dangers caused by these sanctions for the aviation industry. In 2004, Iran presented a report on the negative impacts of the U.S. sanctions to the 35th General Assembly of the ICAO. In that report, Iran detailed how the sanctions on its aviation industry was doing harm. The reasons stated by Iran for lifting the sanctions were based on the contradictions that the sanctions had with the clear objectives stated in the Chicago Convention, which is regarded as the international treaty for the aviation industry and has been signed by all members. In several articles of that convention, it has been reiterated that safety is the number one priority for the aviation industry. Article 4 of the treaty says, each member state agrees not to use civil aviation for any purpose inconsistent with the aims of this convention. Article 44 calls on the members to meet the needs of the people of the world for safe, regular, efficient, and economical air transport, avoid discrimination between contracting states, and promote safety of flight in international air navigation. ICAO deployed a fact-finding mission to Iran to investigate the issues cited in the report. In May 2005, the ICAO issued a report based on the findings of its fact-finding team. The report noted that the U.S. imposed sanctions had threatened the safety of aviation in Iran. It clearly stated that the U.S. sanctions were in contradiction to the spirit and letter of the Chicago Convention, describing the sanctions as a tool for foreign policy. It noted that aviation safety, which affects human life and human rights, stands above political differences. At the end, the report concluded that it was the ICAO's responsibility as a UN agency to take the lead to lift the U.S.-imposed sanctions. Despite all the efforts carried out by Iran and the ICAO, there was no progress made in lifting the sanctions by this means.
The problem is that those ruling, they don't have any enforcement power. They cannot enforce. Just they give some sort of recommendation. The recommendations given to U.S. government that really they are spearheading the sanction, which they don't pay attention to that.
As a result of years of limitations and pressure, Iranian airlines were forced to find alternative ways for their survival. To achieve this goal, the training of specialists in this field was the first step. The airlines made their utmost effort to reduce their dependency on foreign specialists and foreign companies. This could be one of the major achievements of Iranian airlines during this period. Recently, Iran Air announced that it had carried out the C-check of an advanced airplane.
I remember 10 years ago, I wanted to ship one engine to UK. We didn't have engine transportation stand. We asked one of the very famous factory in Iran to build us, and they did. Very nice stand with all specific specification and very accurate dimensions. When we sent engine to UK, They ask us, where is the license for this transportation stand? Why you put our brand on a stand which we don't know about the manufacturer of the stand? Today, we cut to ship engine to that facility. We do repair in house.
The production of spare parts and equipment that could be made locally was also added in the program so Iran could supply some of the parts it needed inside the country. Each year, Iran holds an aviation exhibition in Kish Island to provide a venue for some part manufacturers to showcase their products. Ibrahimi Advanced Simulator Company has been building simulators in one of Tehran's suburbs in the past years. This company, despite its limited resources, carried out its activities using investments from the private sector. Building a flight simulator is a very complex task, and it is normally achieved through the interaction of several separate firms working in cooperation with the manufacturer of the airplane. This company has recently built a simulator for one of the most modern airplanes in the world. Ibrahimi says companies from outside the country are interested in buying the product that was made in his small firm. In 2015, when the world powers in Iran, after years of negotiations, finally signed the nuclear agreement, a large portion of the nuclear sanctions imposed by the United States were lifted. In a short time, broad-ranging negotiations got underway for investments in different sectors of the Iranian industries. Airbus and Boeing, as the biggest manufacturers of airplanes and spare parts, came to Iran and signed several contracts worth billions of dollars. Signing these contracts would make a huge profit for them, and Iran's aviation industry would be revived. Iran Air signed contracts for 100 Airbus airplanes, 80 Boeing jetliners, and 20 ATR aircraft. Iran Asiman Airline signed a deal with Boeing Company for 30 MAX 737 jetliners, which could later be doubled to 60. In June 2017, Airbus announced an initial contract had been signed with Iran Air Tour Company for 45 airplanes, as well as 28 more airplanes for Zagros Company. About 1 week before the U.S. President Donald Trump officially entered the White House, the first Airbus airplane arrived in Tehran, amid a lot of excitement and media hype.
We are committed to partnering in areas like air traffic management, like training of pilots, and of course all the necessary support to Iran Air, who will become one of the greatest Middle East airlines, I'm sure of it.
In the meantime, other Iranian airlines had started talks to buy new airplanes, while Trump was threatening to pull out of the Iran nuclear deal.
The Iran deal, which may be the single worst deal I've ever seen drawn by anybody.
The news alarmed the airplane manufacturers that had signed contracts with the Iranians and were making efforts to save the deals.
In a few moments, I will sign a presidential memorandum to begin reinstating U.S. nuclear sanctions on the Iranian regime. We will be instituting the highest level of economic sanction.
The move was a big shock to international markets, in particular the aviation industry. Airbus, Boeing, and ATR sent representatives to hold talks with the U.S. government so they could save their contracts. Despite all their efforts, OFAC licenses were revoked, and all the contracts were eventually canceled. As a result, after long negotiations to buy more than 250 airplanes, Iran Air received only 16, and once again, efforts to renovate and develop Iran's civil aviation industry ended in failure.
They design a very dirty play against the aviation industry of Iran. They arrive here, they open many gates in front of us, we close those gates that we had before, and then after, they close the new recently opened doors.
One of the last legal actions for lifting the U.S. sanctions had been to lodge a formal complaint at the International Court of Justice. After the U.S. quit the JCPOA, Iran filed a complaint against the United States based on the 1955 Treaty of Amity between the two countries.
Unanimously, the United States of America, in accordance with its obligations under the 1955 Treaty of Amity, shall remove any impediments to the free exportation to the territory of the Islamic Republic of Iran of medicines and medical devices, foodstuffs and agricultural commodities, and spare parts, equipment, and associated services, including warranty, maintenance, repair services, and inspections necessary for the safety of aviation.
In response to the court verdict, the U.S. questioned the jurisdiction of the Court of Law, which is one of the highest regarded legal institutions in the world, and also pulled out of the treaty.
You know, we're disappointed that the court failed to recognize that it has no jurisdiction to issue any order relating to these sanctions measures with the United States. I am therefore announcing today that the United States is terminating the Treaty of Amity with Iran.
Despite being a legal and diplomatic victory for Iran, the court verdict failed to improve conditions in the country, particularly in the aviation industry. Ultimately, Iran, with 310 planes, of which only 150 are active, is once again forced to find new ways of maintaining and growing its air fleet. The sanctions are exerting a lot of pressure on Iranian airlines. Yet many of those working in the aviation industry believe that there is always a way to control the sanctions, or at least reduce their negative impacts to a minimum.
We are facing with the sanction, but we are managing the sanction. We have less aircraft than customer demand in the Iran network, but we are feeding this demand by safety.
In the limelight. Marine Le Pen's far-right party has suffered a serious electoral blow when it failed to win a regional election in its stronghold in southern France. The Rassemblement National has pinned its last chances on taking the Provence-Alpes-Côte d'Azur region after emerging victorious from last week's first-round vote, although by a small margin. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalist Kim Wilshire. The piece is titled Le Pen's far-right party suffers blow in French regional elections. Marine Le Pen's far-right party has suffered a serious electoral blow when it failed to win a regional election in its stronghold in southern France. The Rassemblement National has pinned its last chances on taking the Provence-Alpes-Côte d'Azur region after emerging victorious from last week's first-round vote, albeit by a small margin. However, an alliance of rival parties formed a Republican front against the Rassemblement National, RN, including the withdrawal of the Socialist Party and left-wing alliance candidate, and that prevented the far-right from taking the region. Sunday's result was a final bitter disappointment for the Rassemblement National RN, which had been predicted to do well in at least five regions in the first round vote last Sunday, 20th of June. In the end, the Rassemblement National came first only in the Provence-Alpes-Côte d'Azur region, and then only by a narrow margin. Exit polls suggested that the Les Républicains candidate in PACA, Renaud Muselier, had polled a convincing 56.6% of votes against the Rassemblement National RM's Thierry Mariani's 43.4%. Afterwards, Marine Le Pen said local democracy was suffering a profound crisis and criticized the unnatural alliances made between political rivals to confound a Rassemblement National RN victory and prevent us from showing that we can win a region. In a brief but defiant post-election speech, Marine Le Pen added that the abstention rate showed a discontentment among electors that was a major signal for all political class and society in France. While many saw these elections as a warm-up for next year's presidential election,